91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's complicated digital and media eras are products of visionaries such as Gates, Jobs, Zuckerberg, and Glass. But at the dawn of the media age, enormous personalities shaped the formation of powerful news and entertainment networks. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We'll speak with Scott Woolley, author of The Networks, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. It's the story of two personalities, David Sarnoff and Edwin Armstrong. Sarnoff was the Russian immigrant who created the powerful RCA network. Edwin Armstrong developed the audio amplifier, the modern transmitter, and FM radio. They were once great friends, but became bitter rivals. Listen for the story in minutes after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. officials say the attack on Istanbul's main airport yesterday carries all the hallmarks of an ISIS operation. NPR's Dina Temple-Rassen reports investigators say the attack tracks very closely to that of an attack in Brussels in May.
Two officials briefed on the Istanbul attacks say the assailants arrived in a taxi and began shooting as soon as they reached the terminal entrance. And while the investigation is only beginning, Turkish officials believe that there were at least three foreign nationals involved. Among other things, they're studying security footage both inside and outside the airport to see if the attackers may have had accomplices. While officials believe ISIS may be behind the attack, the group has yet to claim responsibility. Today is the second anniversary of ISIS's declaration of the caliphate, or Muslim homeland. Knowing that, officials say, they don't think the timing of the Istanbul attack is coincidental. Dina Temple-Rastin, NPR News.
The health minister of Turkey says 41 people remain in intensive care. They were among more than 230 to be wounded in the attacks. At least 41 people lost their lives. The victims reportedly include citizens from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iran, Ukraine, and Switzerland. The National Rifle Association is attacking the Democrats' presumptive nominee Hillary Clinton in its first campaign ad of the presidential election season. The group's political victory fund is spending more than $2 million and targeting seven states with the ad. NPR's Sarah McCammon reports it does not focus on gun rights.
The NRA is going after the presumptive Democratic nominee over her record as the former Secretary of State. The ad highlights the terrorist attack on a U.S. diplomatic compound in Libya in 2012 that killed four Americans. It features Marine Corps veteran Mark Ozgeist.
Hillary is president? No thanks. I served in Benghazi. My friends didn't make it. They did their part. Do yours.
The House Benghazi Committee's report, released yesterday, heavily faulted the military's response to the attack, but had little new to say about Clinton's role. The NRA has endorsed presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump. Sarah McCammon, NPR News.
The fallout from the Brexit vote, trade, and the environment are expected to figure prominently in today's high-level North American talks in Ottawa. NPR Scott Horsley reports on the significance of President Obama's trip today.
The North American leaders are often dubbed the Three Amigos, and this year at least, that name seems to fit. A White House advisor says on energy policy, leaders of the U.S., Mexico, and Canada are now more aligned than they've been in decades. Of course, their close continental cooperation could take a sharp turn if Donald Trump's elected in November. Trump has loudly disparaged Mexican immigrants, and he's called for renegotiating or abandoning the North American Free Trade Agreement.
NPR Scott Horsley. This is NPR News.
From the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald, I'm Christine DiMattei. Miami-Dade police officers raiding the home of a suspected marijuana trafficker yesterday got a big surprise, at least $24 million in cash, all in bundles of $100 bills stuffed in 5-gallon buckets. Detectives say the money was found inside a secret compartment in the attic of a Miami Lakes home. It already qualifies as the largest cash seizure in the history of the Miami-Dade Police Department. Florida Democrats are not giving up on calling for a special legislative session to deal with gun control. That request is a direct response to the Orlando massacre. As Amy Green tells us, they're calling for reform that would close what they call a terror loophole, allowing known or suspected terrorists to buy guns.
The legislation would prohibit gun sales in Florida to those on the terrorist watch list, a national database of known or suspected terrorists. The Pulse shooter was investigated twice for possible terrorist ties before lawfully purchasing guns days before his attack. Here's Representative Jared Moskowitz of Coral Springs.
It's very simple. If you're not a terrorist or a suspected terrorist, this will not affect you.
The Democrats say they have enough support to require Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner to poll each member of the legislature on whether a special session should be called. A special session must be called if 3/5 of the legislature agrees. Amy Green in Orlando.
Meanwhile, Florida Senate President Andy Gardner says he will not support a special session to discuss gun control legislation. Eric Rawlings, who chairs the Orange County Soil and Water Conservation District, thinks such a bill has bipartisan appeal.
I don't think this is really a partisan issue. I think it's gotten to the point where what we're asking for today, those are pretty basic things. It's not about taking anybody's guns away.
But Gardner, who is Republican, said in a statement that he would vote against a special session. Gardner said Florida cannot pass a law requiring the federal government to turn over information about terrorism investigations. This is WLRN Miami Herald News. I'm Christine DiMatte.
My fellow Americans, this is Bernie Sanders. And if you want to join the revolution, then you've got to listen to the Capitol Steps 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday. Sure, the 2% will be listening to something else, but you might tune in and hear from me.
If there were no rich men, if the 2% could see that being rich is...
So please listen to the Capitol Steps 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday on this public radio station.
That's Monday, July 4th at 1 o'clock.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Staples, with thousands of printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
And we're back 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Well, this hour we visit with technology and business writer Scott Woolley. He's chronicled the 40-year relationship between a famed broadcast network entrepreneur, that would be David Sarnoff, and a brilliant inventor, Edwin Armstrong, who developed the frequency modulated, or FM, radio system you're probably listening to now. Also, he invented much more.
David Sarnoff was a media titan who was a true visionary. He controlled both RCA and NBC, but was often considered a contemptible individual. Scott Woolley thinks he was grossly misunderstood. Sarnoff was great friends with inventor Edwin Armstrong, who advanced the first audio amplifier, radio transmitters, and FM radio.
Scott Woolley's book is The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. And he joins us from Marketplace, Los Angeles. Welcome to you, Scott.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. You know, I'd say that despite the fact that this story is really about the origins of American wireless communications, it's relatively unknown. So you worked on this for several years. Why did you want to tell it? And were you surprised that some people didn't know so much about it?
Absolutely. I was surprised at the beginning at how little I knew about it, and I had been working for Forbes magazine covering kind of modern telecommunications and all the explosion in new wireless apps that are kind of changing the 21st century, and just got really intrigued by the airwaves that make this all possible, and then some of these crazy stories from the 20th century about the dawn of the wireless age, and I kind of got sucked in that way. And then the story between these two, this brilliant inventor and this brilliant businessman, is what really kind of made me think it was worth a book.
Something that really struck me is how much in the past that government was so much more tolerant of monopolies and the way they just kind of gave things away to these big companies.
Yes, and I think it tended to take the government by surprise, like it took everybody else by surprise, you know, how big a deal AM radio was. Before that, how big a deal the wireless telegraph was. So when they were giving away these initial monopolies, they didn't really understand what they were giving in a lot of cases. The people who were getting them often didn't know the value of them. But as the value of the airways multiplied and the value of wireless communications multiplied, these government giveaways were just, when you look back, absolutely remarkable.
And dating back to wired communications, the logic was that, well, we can't have telephone lines all over the city, you know, owned by 8 different companies.
There's a great logic, and after World War One, before World War One, the wireless telegraph business didn't really work, and it was during that war that the U.S. Navy came and took it over, and this was sort of the founding of RCA. They realized having a bunch of different wireless telegraph companies didn't make a lot of sense, so they formed the Radio Corporation of America to be a monopoly and to make the industry really work. That obviously went well for a little while, and then all of a sudden people sort of regretted the monopoly powers that had given away. But there's a sort of push and pull, because it does make sense in the 1920s to have a single telephone network. And so in a lot of cases, there was this tension, and the government never really made up their mind about exactly where the line should be.
Well, why don't we start with this friendship, this 40-year friendship between Edwin Armstrong and David Sarnoff, by giving us a snapshot, beginning with David Sarnoff and his early experiences and like how he got to Marconi.
Sure. And he was the one, as he mentioned in your intro, that I really came around on in the reporting of this book. I had sort of expected him to be a supporting character and a villain, as he had often been portrayed. And he ended up being a much more sympathetic character than that. And it gets back to his origin story. He was born in what is now what became the Soviet Union, emigrated, and shows up in New York City as a penniless Russian immigrant in 1900. And 5-6 years later, he is looking for a job. His father has just died. He's an 8th grade graduate. And so he gets a job with the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company, the first wireless, publicly traded wireless company in the world. And from there, he just fell in love with the airwaves and the idea of connecting people around the world instantaneously. It's a real Horatio Alger story. He didn't like that. He didn't like to be called a Horatio Alger,
right.
But I mean, he rose from absolutely nothing to then go on to be this powerful media mogul.
And as an aside, Marconi's, which, you know, became so big, was really nothing at a certain point until the Titanic, which I also thought was pretty interesting.
Well, that was another thing that I really came up. Marconi has this sort of heroic image, sort of the opposite of Sarnoff's. He was a great businessman, but a much less of an inventor than his reputation sort of has made him out to be. And, you know, he struggled for 10 years promising technology that didn't work. And the only thing that came along to save him was the sinking of the Titanic. And there were 2 Marconi operators on that ship. They summoned help. And that was the first moment when the world said, hey, these airwaves aren't really a joke or a parlor trick. They just saved 700 people's lives. They're an incredibly valuable tool. So Marconi was rescued, and Sarnoff, mm-hmm. his employee at the time, really saw how that publicity surrounding the Titanic changed the fortunes of the wireless industry.
So it sounds rather simplistic now, but the essence of David Sarnoff, I guess, was that to look at this communication not as point to point, but point to the masses.
Yes, and that was his friend Armstrong, who we'll talk about, was, and some of the other inventors were creating all these new ways to make communications cheaper with better technology. And Sarnoff had this vision of making communications cheaper with a better business model. Instead of just recreating the phone system, doing what we're doing now, broadcasting, having one conversation and having hundreds of thousands or even millions of people listen to it. And as a result, each individual connection is very cheap. And that created this boom in radio. And so Sarnoff was an inventor of new business models, I suppose you could say, which isn't exactly quite the same thing, but it was critical to helping radio get off the ground.
So let's now go to Edwin Armstrong and wherever you want to pick him up.
Sure. Well, he was born within 3 months of Sarnoff, but had a very different background. Grew up upper middle class in New York, went to Columbia, was a sort of star engineering student there. And so he and Sarnoff meet up when they're both 22, 23, and Armstrong has his first great invention, this vacuum tube amplifier, and they have this famous night that I make a chapter in the book where they go to a Marconi company radio telegraph antenna in New Jersey. This is in 1912, and 1914, and they for the first time hook up Armstrong's amplifier to these big antennas and start getting wireless telegraph messages from Hawaii and from Germany. And so those two are really the first people ever to see what the airwaves can do and how they can connect the entire planet. And it was that kind of moment. It was this real bonding moment for the two of them, and it made them just passionate optimists about what the possibilities of the airwaves were for the rest of their lives.
Going back earlier in the life of Edwin Armstrong, though, and perhaps something that's more revealing about his psyche in the long run, is that he suffered from St. Vitus dance, which, of course, led him to not be very socially acceptable, I suppose. So he withdrew into this world of mechanical gadgets and electricity.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And he was... like many, although certainly not all engineers, really great with machines and not quite as good with people. And he had a very uncompromising view of the way people should live their lives. And it was admirable. He always fought for justice. But Sarnoff's point that he began to make to him as time went on was that just fighting the good fight and ignoring whether you were going to win, how important the fight was, doesn't make a lot of sense. And so Armstrong was this... He had trouble compromising with other people, and he had trouble letting things go. So it was a very complicated and interesting personality, and they were great friends because they had this shared passion for the airwaves and the business that the airwaves could create. But in almost every other way, they were entirely different.
How did they find each other, though? You talk about this night when they realized, you know, the power of the airwaves, but who initiated this friendship? Who sought whom?
Well, they were both, the New York wireless community back in 1910 was pretty small, so they were, they ran in the same circles, and their precise first meeting is sort of lost to history. But it was, Armstrong had been starting to tout this idea that he could amplify radio signals 1,000-fold. All the experts said that was crazy and ignored him. And Sarnoff, who was now relatively senior at the Marconi company, was the one guy and the other optimist. And they were bound by this optimism. And he's like, let's give it a try. And so they did this experiment. And sure enough, the amplifier worked. And it kind of helped make Sarnoff's name eventually, because he was great at seeing the next technology that was coming down the road as a result of his endless optimism.
We're speaking with Scott Woolley. He's a technology and business writer and media historian. He's written The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves, and The Birth of the Communication Age. We're going to take a short break on today's topical currents, and we'll resume in a moment.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Air Como. Does your business use compressed air or vacuum? Air Como's professionals have been servicing the compressed air and vacuum requirements of businesses in South Florida for over 15 years. More information at aircomo.com.
The Community Arts Program Summer Concert Series continues 8 p.m. Thursday, July 7th at Coral Gables Congregational United Church of Christ with Grammy Awarded jazz vocal favorite Catherine Russell with Billie Holiday lyricism and Sarah Vaughan depth. Catherine Russell appears with guitarist Matt Munisteri, pianist Mark Shane, and bassist Tal Ronan. Also on the series, Terry Lynn Carrington, Peter and Will Anderson Jazz Trio, and guitarist Sir Angel Romero. Tickets and info at 305-448-7421 at communityartsprogram.org.
org.
WLRN's fiscal year ends on June 30th. Help us to meet our budgeted goal and keep bringing you great news and programs all year long. Become a member or make an additional gift by visiting WLRN.org.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with technology and business writer Scott Woolley. We're talking about his book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. We're talking about David Sarnoff and also Edwin Armstrong. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, there's some fascinating history this hour. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email if you like, that's radio@WLRN.org.
Okay, so Scott, so all goes well for about 20 years between them and with AM radio. So if you'll just talk about some of the things that happened during those 20 years.
Sure, well, it was the big shift in we mentioned it briefly, was in following World War One, the wireless telegraph. People kind of forget that there was this battle between the undersea telegraph cables to move instant information instantly between the United States and Europe. And so at the beginning, for the first 20 years, the wireless industry was purely focused on sending dots and dashes through the air across the ocean or to ships like the Titanic. So the big shift, and this is what Sarnoff pushed, was the idea of broadcasting instead of doing one-to-one communication, creating radio broadcasting. And the technology for that only really became available partly because of some of Edwin Armstrong's additional inventions. But that only happened in the 1920s. So that's when we think about the birth of radio as being in the 20s. That's just AM radio specifically. But the industry booms. People love it. It connects the country in a way that is no one ever thought possible. It takes off as a technology with unprecedented speed. So by the early 1930s, when Armstrong gets around to inventing FM radio, AM has turned the Radio Corporation of America into kind of the nation's hottest stock through the 1920s. It's led to the creation of the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, as a subsidiary of RCA. So it was really radio broadcasting that turned the wireless industry from an important niche into a booming industry.
So then comes FM. So talk about that, which Sarnoff, Armstrong also was the inventor of.
Yes. And whereas AM radio had many fathers, I think, I mean, many inventors who invented kind of critical components, I think Armstrong can get almost the full credit for FM. And so he shows it, and it becomes this meeting that both Sarnoff and Armstrong will look back on for the rest of their lives as this sort of critical moment when their friendship began to fall apart. Armstrong picks Sarnoff up at 30 Rock, which Sarnoff has made into RCA and NBC's headquarters, drives him up to Columbia University and gives him an FM radio demonstration. Now, to Armstrong, this was the moment when Sarnoff said, "Oh my God, you've invented the technology that's going to ruin RCA." And to Sarnoff, he would look back and say, "This is the moment where I said that my friend had invented something that seemed very promising, but it was unclear exactly what it was going to be." And so, obviously, as time went on and FM proved itself as a dramatically superior technology, especially in World War II, Armstrong felt vindicated, and his theory that David Sarnoff had intentionally set out to cripple FM and ruin FM to protect AM just went from, you know, being something he suspected to something he just passionately believed, sometimes no matter what the contrary evidence.
Do some of this debate center on the fact that the big AM stations, the early powerhouse AM stations, had Clear Channel after the Communications Act, so that an FM is a line of sight signal, so you couldn't have those big booming stations out of Chicago and New York and St. Louis that dominated the country?
Yes, and there's a couple pieces to that. One is that the AM industry itself, sort of thought of this monolith, or because RCA and CBS ran the big networks, it was assumed that they were the real powers in the AM industry. In fact, there were hundreds of independent AM stations whose interests diverged from those of NBC and CBS. Bigger limits on FM after World War II were less a result of the technological limitations you just described and much more a result of the regulatory limitations that the FCC slapped on the new technology in order to prevent the rise of FM monopolies, which is sort of a crazy story in and of itself.
Yeah, but talk about that, though. I mean, here you have these monopolies, so why were they so vested and wanted to thwart the development of FM if it was a better technology?
So that's the question that I don't think Armstrong ever really answered well in his lawsuits, in his congressional investigations that he spurred. And the key distinction to me is that when you look at the AM industry, even in 1940, the majority of the income was being earned by the local stations. Some of the big radio networks, the national networks, were not making money. And then the government came in and slapped all these restrictions on the big national networks and basically turned all the power over to the local stations. So it was the local AM radio stations that stood the most to lose from FM. But Armstrong only saw NBC as the face of AM radio and therefore sued NBC, sued RCA, and avoided and sort of confronting the real power in AM, which were the local stations that, as I say, had the most to lose.
And what happened with his lawsuit?
It went on. So he filed it in 1948 after his congressional investigations failed. And FM was... this was the real tragedy, is FM comes out of World War II having proven itself on the battlefield as a far superior technology. The military has purchased millions of FM radios. Every scientist says it works better. Every economist says it'll be cheaper to run. But then because of these restrictions that the FCC puts on FM, the industry goes into decline. That's when Armstrong sues RCA, convinced that it must be his good friend who is behind this betrayal, and unwilling to look at any other culprit behind the demise of FM radio from 1945 for another 30 years. The industry was, losing money and very unprofitable, despite being vastly superior to its AM competitors.
Scott, could you touch on this idea that we have now about a network, be it television or radio? Of course, it's dominated by the satellite and distributed by satellite for the most part. But of course, in those days, the networks were dependent on telephone lines to go across the country, which of course were controlled by Bell Telephone.
None other than AT&T.
So that complicated things even more. So there was a monopoly distributing these feeds.
Absolutely. And so there were three parts to the radio. I mean, if you were listening to a radio show in the 30s or 40s, you needed the network in New York to actually produce the program. It then turned it over to the phone company to deliver it to, say, Kansas, and then your local Kansas radio station to broadcast it so that you could hear it. So the phone company occupied a very powerful place. The local radio stations occupied a very powerful place because they were also monopolies or near monopolies in their markets. But the networks were the face of the industry, so they tended to get all the government regulation and restriction, and which is part of what caused a lot of the problems, because there was just a failure to understand the way the radio industry really worked and who made the money.
How did the FCC come to have so much power to regulate who used the airwaves, which really, I mean, I know they needed some control over it, but they really belong to everybody. So how did they come to be so powerful?
This is a great story, and I didn't actually make it into the book, but it starts with a 1939 World Series. Some of the big radio networks blocked their affiliates from carrying the games. And so the FCC at the time, this new agency, saw this as a way to kind of jump in, protect the public, and make a name for itself. It winds up in a big Supreme Court case in 1943, and basically what the Supreme Court says in NBC versus U.S. is that the FCC, Congress had given the FCC the power to oversee the communications market, and while it hadn't said it should do things like enforce the antitrust laws, it also said it never said that the FCC couldn't. And so that court case gave the FCC this massive power to do basically whatever it wanted within some narrow restrictions. And it was that case that then led to a series of flawed decisions by the FCC to try to improve the communications market in ways that ultimately ended up doing the exact opposite.
Right.
But at its essence and at its founding, the FCC really was to keep frequencies from being jammed by simultaneous broadcast of stations, say, within the same market on the same AM band.
That's clearly a critical role. The government has to come in and essentially set property rights. You know, if you're broadcasting on 89.3, you don't want somebody else doing the same thing. But it went far beyond that original mission to start doing things like regulating the relationships between radio networks and local stations. Right now, the FCC is regulating the relationships between internet service providers like Comcast and other networks, and that's the big net neutrality debate. So this argument over what the FCC should be doing is a very modern one, but it all started back in the 30s.
We're going to take another break. We're speaking with Scott Woolley. He's written The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves, and The Birth of the Communication Age. And we'll come back again. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or radio at WLRN.org.
You can become a confident leader in your chosen field. St. Thomas University's new cutting-edge graduate programs are designed for fast acceleration to success. You can now get a top-notch private education at a cost you can afford with St. Thomas University's new graduate program, offering reduced tuition that includes books. Learn more at stu.edu/grad school.
WLRN's fiscal year ends on June 30th. Help us to meet our budgeted goal and keep bringing you great news and programs all year long. Become a member or make an additional gift by visiting WLRN.org.
Okay, let's admit one thing here. A colonoscopy is not something you usually want to talk much about, but you might be paying a lot for one without knowing. In South Florida, a colonoscopy can cost $600 to $5,000. WLRN's Price Check Reporting Project is an online database of healthcare costs, and we want to know how much you paid for a colonoscopy. You can share what you paid and find out what others paid at WLRN.org/pricecheck.
And we're back. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're talking about the book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. It's written by technology and business writer Scott Woolley. He's a former Forbes bureau chief, also has written for Slate magazine, and is a media historian. Scott, tell us more about how Sarnoff allegedly tried to suppress FM and keep the power with AM. What other means did he use?
Sure. So Armstrong's allegations that were first leveled in Congress, he convinced senator and some congressmen to hold hearings and investigations, and then later when those didn't work out, he sort of repeated the same allegations in court. At one point he said, You will find the hand of RCA management working in the background to defeat FM radio. Ever since that day, I showed it to David Sarnoff at Columbia University. You know, he was very clear about about who the villain was, but he never had a smoking gun. So when the FCC moved the FM dial now goes from 88 to 108, that was created after World War II when the FCC took it upon themselves to change it. I think it was from about 40 to 48 before the old FM radios. So this was a move that forced the whole FM radio industry to start from scratch. There was no scientific basis for it. And it was supported by CBS, the other big AM radio network, and a lot of AM stations. But it was opposed by NBC. It was publicly opposed by NBC. So the fact that Armstrong just couldn't wrap his head around this idea that someone was out to get him, and in fact they were, but that it wasn't his friend Sarnoff. He just lumped in Sarnoff. He just made it personal in the absence of evidence. And there are other examples about rules. CBS came out with this idea to limit the range of FM stations, to forbid them from passing FM signals from station to station without the aid of the phone company, which FM was capable of doing. The FCC made it all illegal, and in every case, RCA actually opposed those rules. So this was the baffling thing to me as I was originally trying to prove Sarnoff was this villain that Armstrong said he was that in every case, the evidence seemed to point the other way when you actually got down and looked at the history and the original sources.
In the late 40s, early 50s, FM was really the bailiwick for the beginning of educational radio, which morphed into public radio. School boards such as the Miami School Board had licenses, and many other communities, the school boards had FM licenses early.
Yes, and FM opened up this whole new world of better sounding stations and more stations. And this is what the AM industry really was afraid of. And because they designed these rules that essentially made it impossible to run a profitable FM station, FM was largely taken over at the beginning by nonprofits who suffered under some of these same restrictions. But there was a push for nonprofit radio kind of on the model of Britain and many other countries. And so it was sort of pushed into FM when few people had FM radios and the FM signals didn't work that well. It's not like today because of these restrictions. I think you guys have 100,000 watts.
Right.
That was illegal in the 40s and 50s and 60s in order to prevent FM monopolies.
It started out with 8,000 watts monaural in 1951, I believe, and it carried classical music and also a lot of actual in-school instruction, language instruction, history and kindergarten programming.
Yeah, and that's one of the real tragedies about FM is that it's great that it could do that, but it could have done so much more. It could have carried so many more of those programs. There could have been, I mean, as vibrant as public radio ultimately grew up to be, it could have happened earlier and could have been even more vibrant if it had more channels and been able to, you know, more power earlier on. So it's great that FM provided a home for early public radio, but also to me sort of a tragedy that it was done in such a limited form compared to what the technology was actually capable of.
And was that all on account of the FCC?
It was all on account of rules passed by the FCC. So the only question is whether the FCC crippled FM radio out of incompetence or corruption. That is, did the AM radio industry buy them off and bribe them? And there are some isolated instances of bribery in the FCC. Or did it just pass these rules in a good faith effort to prevent FM radio monopolies and succeed to the extent that it basically made all FM radio uneconomic for 3 decades. So, I can't prove that it's corruption over incompetence, but there's a substantial amount of circumstantial evidence that that's the case.
What about, let's get back, I want to know what was Sarnoff doing all this time that Armstrong was obsessed with, you know, being with that acrimony. Did he do anything to assuage his good friend's anger? I mean, were there ever attempts made to reconcile?
Yes, and he sent a number of emissaries, famous engineers who were on RCA's board. He invited Armstrong to lunch. So he reached out, and it became a fight about Armstrong didn't think that RCA was willing to pay him high enough royalties on his FM invention. So that was sort of the conflict before World War II broke out. The war caused everybody to take a break and pay attention to other things. And when they came back, the friendship was sort of beyond repair, at least as Armstrong considered it. And Sarnoff was busy on other things. His contention in these hundreds of pages of depositions, Armstrong's lawyer would say, why weren't you paying more attention to FM radio? Why you were intentionally ignoring it? Mm-hmm. And Sarnoff's case was that, hey, I was looking at TV. I was trying to make television happen. I was working on all these other technologies. And that's what I was really fascinated with. And that's there's a vast amount of evidence that that's true. I mean, that was Sarnoff's personality. He once said, I don't really care that much about the past, and I'm not that interested in the present. What fascinates me is the future. And so at the time, in the 30s, the future was either FM radio or TV, and he found TV, for obvious reasons, a lot more interesting.
Tell us, Scott, more about the actual power of those early radio networks in the golden age of radios in the 30s. You know, we've been talking about RCA and NBC, but of course, NBC was broken off into different networks. One of them actually became ABC. Tell us how that happened.
Sure. Well, at the beginning, RCA created NBC not to be this profitable monopoly network. They created it so that there'd be something for people to listen to on their radios because they were trying to sell radios. So at first it was purely done as this sort of way of creating interesting content for the radios where RCA would make its real money. And by the late 1930s, the stations, the networks, the big CBS network, and NBC's main red network were in fact profitable. But that's when the government kind of had this change of heart. And in that case that we talked about earlier, the Supreme Court approved the FCC's move to force NBC to split up its two radio networks, and that created ABC. So it was, again, this battle over what are the proper lines of monopoly that forced the creation of ABC. And it's interesting to note that after ABC was created, it, far from being this valuable monopoly or, like, valuable network in terms of being able to make money, ABC lost money for decades to come, both in radio and in television, and was only able to stay in business because of the local stations it owned.
Let's talk about what happened to Edwin Armstrong, his fate. Clearly, he was living the good life, and then come the 1950s, and what happens?
Sure, and I opened the book with this because that question to me was what really involved me in this story. You know, I opened it in 1954, last day of January. He's in his penthouse apartment. You know, he's fantastically rich, even though he spent a lot of money on lawyers. He's still he's a war hero. He's a Ivy League professor, and he jumps out his window, blaming Sarnoff. So distraught is he, this amazing inventor and brilliant guy, that he jumps out of his window on the 40th anniversary of the day that he and David Sarnoff had gone and tested out his first amplifier. And it's clearly a message to his old friend that he might be losing in court. He might not be able to prove that Sarnoff had betrayed him, but this is going to be his final message to the world. And so to me, it's that question of what was the truth behind what really happened to FM radio and all these things that Armstrong blamed on David Sarnoff. Who was the real villain? And it's that suicide and his choice to take that, to end a life. I mean, it doesn't make sense for anyone, but for someone of this accomplishment and brilliance to do it is all the more tragic. And the real causes are sort of the driving mystery of the book.
Not in a technical, psychological or psychiatric sense, but was it actually paranoia that was his undoing?
I think, he suffered through decades of injustice in a lot of ways. There was this case on his early radio amplifier that he fought to the Supreme Court twice. I think it was the longest
case in the history of the U.S. patent system, because he kept fighting, and he lost kind of unfairly. And then FM radio comes along. He donates all his FM patents to the military during the war, proves that it's a better technology. And how does his country repay him? By passing a bunch of regulations that cripples the superior technology and destroys the new industry. And then he can't prove, he's convinced his best friend has betrayed him, and he can't prove that. So it is that, you know, decades-long buildup of frustration and injustice that absolutely was a major contributing factor to his suicide. I'm not a psychiatrist, there's other issues that have to come into play, but there's no question that 2 decades of feeling, a deep sense of injustice can really build up.
Well, certainly there were some, I don't know what the psychiatric diagnosis was, but clearly there were some psychiatric problems.
Didn't Farnsworth have similar feelings and fallout?
Yeah, and not quite to the same extreme extent, but this was sort of, and it really speaks to the way our country deals with new technology. Because it uses a patent system that was designed hundreds of years ago and was great when an individual invention could kind of stand on its own. The cotton gin, when Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, it was his invention. With AM radio, there were 4,000 patents that RCA owned. So 4,000 patents, and that's AM radio. When TV comes along, someone like Philo Farnsworth invents a critical component, but it's one of many components you need. What Farnsworth invented would not have made a working television station, would not have made commercial television possible. You needed a bunch of other inventions from other people. And what tended to happen, both in the case of Armstrong and Farnsworth, is that if you're an inventor, you invent a critical piece of something, you tend to think you should get paid the most, that it's the most valuable thing, that you should have the rights and everybody else is less important. Everybody else tends to have a different view. And so Sarnoff's job as the head of RCA was to try to get all the patents you needed to build a working television, and then figure out a fair system for compensating their inventors. This was a system designed to make people angry, to make people think there was a great, injustice had been perpetuated on them, and to not reach a really fair result.
We're speaking with Scott Woolley, technology and business writer and media historian, about his book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communication Age. One more break, and we'll be right back.
This week on All Things Considered, there are 47,000 homeless people in the Los Angeles area. More and more of them are women.
I came downtown on Skid Row in 2003. That's when the bottom fell out of my life.
And on the streets.
I saw killings. I saw people get raped.
Plus, a look ahead to what happens to Britain after its break from the EU. Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
Listen every afternoon at 4 for All Things Considered right here on WLRN. You can pay your Miami-Dade water and sewer bill online, anytime, anywhere. You can pay with your credit card, pay with your bank account, or enroll in AutoPay to receive paperless billing and pay online. Sign up information at miamidade.gov/water.
The WLRN mobile app is available now for Apple and Android devices. Search WLRN in the Apple App Store or in Google Play. You'll have unlimited access to WLRN radio, live broadcasts, news stories, features, and more. The WLRN mobile app, it's free and available now.
My fellow Americans, this is Bernie Sanders, and if you want to join the revolution, then you've got to listen to the Capitol Steps 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday. Sure, the 2% will be listening to something else, but you might tune in and hear from me.
If there were no rich men, if the 2% could see that being rich is...
So please listen to the Capitol Steps 4th of July edition of Politics Takes a Holiday on this public radio station.
Tune in Monday at 1.
Yeah, we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Scott Woolley. We're talking about his book, The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576 is our number. 1-800-743-WLRN. Scott, during our break, Bonnie and I were laughing a little bit, and she wants to hear the story of Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing that he actually controlled the media in Texas.
Yes, and I should say...
And Lady Bird.
And Lady Bird. Yes. Well, it was her.
And so to give credit where it's due, I did... most of this book is based on original reporting, but I have to say the LBJ stuff, while it is little known, I took this story largely from Robert Caro, one of LBJ's biographers, right, and a few other people. But the story itself is amazing because Johnson is a young congressman in the early 40s, just when the FCC is giving away all these valuable AM radio licenses. And the FCC is also in trouble because there's a lot of people in Congress who think it's a failed experiment and just want to do away with it. LBJ becomes pals with people at the FCC, becomes their sort of defender in Congress, and simultaneously his wife wins the rights to a radio station in Austin, and that is the birth of kind of the Johnson media empire. Long story short,
not too much
such
a conflict of interest. I mean, that he was doing this and in Congress and allowing all these things to go through the FCC.
Absolutely. It was the reason the airwaves are such a great form of a great bribery payment, I guess you could say, is that they're invisible. And so this massive amount of wealth that was shifted to a congressman was kind of kept invisible because you're right, he's selling influence. And so every FCC decision that comes up breaks in favor of Lady Bird Johnson to extend the power of the station, to win a new TV station, to extend that station's power. Over and over again, every FCC decision breaks Johnson's way. And as a result, he becomes massively wealthy by the time he's the president.
Isn't that an incredible story? Were you aware of that? I mean, had you read that biography? Did you know that?
Well, we knew he owned the stations.
Right.
But I had known a little bit of it, and a few of Johnson's biographies definitely delve into the shady past. And there was even some, Life magazine did some good reporting back in the 60s as to the source of his empire. And the other thing that really did surprise me was that while Johnson was the best at it, plenty of other senators and congressmen were playing the exact same game. The number of people in Congress who ended up conveniently owning a minority stake in a highly profitable radio station or a highly profitable VHF television station was very high. The committee chairman of the people who oversaw the FCC owned stakes in these stations. When Johnson was the Senate Majority Leader, not only did he own stations, the Republican, the Senate Minority Leader, also owned a stake in our Oakland radio station. So it was a pervasive form of graft in Congress in the late 20th century.
Well, another way to sway that opinion also is that most every major daily newspaper, right, in the United States, with all of their power, also had a VHF TV station.
Yes, and those were oftentimes political payoffs, basically, that either the politicians would know that if you're a right or left-leaning newspaper, you would create a right or left-leaning TV or radio station. And sometimes there's a famous case in Boston where it got really ugly, the grant of one of these TV stations. I mean, they're giving away hundreds of millions of dollars by the late 60s when they create a new VHF station, and everybody knows it. And then everybody has to play this game where they're applying for this license just to serve the public and not because it's worth $100 million.
Right.
So all over the country, it formed a source or, became the cause of corruption.
Talk about William Pally from CBS.
He was a great character. I mean, so
Paley.
the real rival of David Sarnoff in that he ran CBS when NBC and CBS were the two big rivals, but utterly different. He had no interest in technology except to the extent that it could help his business a little bit, but no real personal interest. And he had a great interest in show business. So he would date starlets. He would hobnob with all of the CBS stars. And Sarnoff, meanwhile, would snub all of NBC's most famous, Jackie Gleason and other famous comedians. He didn't want to hang out with them. He wanted to go to the labs and hang out with RCA's researchers. So Paley, it was an interesting rivalry because Paley would often beat him when it came to things like getting Lucille Ball and I Love Lucy, because Paley understood how the value of the stars in the public's mind, and he was willing to pay them kind of what the public said they were worth. Sarnoff wanted to pay his scientists more and thought comedians were interchangeable. So it was a great rivalry between the two. They both had their strengths. They both had their weaknesses. They ended up, at the end of their lives, becoming close friends in a way that it's really tragic that Sarnoff and Armstrong were never able to have that kind of rapprochement. Paley and Sarnoff ended up, by the end of their lives, and Paley spent a lot of time at Sarnoff's deathbed talking about, you know, appreciating the strengths the other person had had after 30 years of fighting.
But Sarnoff was amazing as a visionary, as we mentioned in the intro. And talk about some of his some of the ways he was a visionary, even when, you know, in the 1960s, when he was at the end of his life.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things Paley gave him credit for. He said, "I will always think of David Sarnoff as our industry's, I think it was, wisest prophet." And it was this ability that Sarnoff had to foresee the next technology. So we talked about how when everybody was focusing on the wireless telegraph, he had moved on to AM radio. When people were talking about radio, he had moved on to television. The same thing happened with color television, satellite communication, microwave communication. And then the really amazing thing that I found in doing this research was this speech he gave in 1965. He's 76 years old at this time, just about to retire, and he basically tells an entire ballroom at the Waldorf Astoria about the coming of the internet. He describes how all the networks we have right now are going to collapse, and that we will just have all digital communication. There will be these storehouses of digitized information that anybody will be able to tap. It will connect the world. And he pegged the two technologies that were going to make this possible: fiber optic cables, which he called laser pipes, which is a way better name for the technology. It describes them much better than the term, the fiber optic term we use now, and microchips, computers. So he was a man driven by optimism and driven by his belief that scientists, his scientists, he liked to call them, would find new ways to connect the world. And so as technological prophets go, I don't think Sarnoff has ever been matched. And I think it tells us a lot about the future here in the 21st century as well.
Really? I wonder who's going to take a page from the Sarnoff book and say what's coming next. But we've run out of time. We've been talking with Scott Woolley. He's a technology and business writer, media historian, formerly Forbes Los Angeles bureau chief, and a Forbes telecom correspondent. He's written about tech and business affairs for numerous publications, and his first book and the book we've been discussing is The Network, The Battle for the Airwaves and the Birth of the Communications Age. Scott Woolley, thanks so much. It's been really a pleasure.
Thank you, Scott.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And we appreciate your listening this hour. Our lead producer, Richard Ives, technical direction from Jason Zabka. Polly Landis is associate producer. And remember our free audio archive of each program. That's available at our website, WLRN.org. You may want to link it to a friend or just listen again. And join Bonnie and me tomorrow for a program which begins with discussion of how South Florida municipalities and suburbs can be revitalized with improved economic opportunities and looks. And Linda Gassenheimer tells about new South Florida fast food efforts in the area of Middle East cuisine. Join us then for Topical Currents. That's tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.
During an election year, you